Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. My name is Nicholas Miller, and I'm here with the recently recovered, but still defatigable, Steve Cato.
I was pretty fatigued earlier. After the last Talking Show we recorded, I immediately became ill. And likely careful listeners can still detect this in my voice.
Yeah, there is a touch of that for sure. It's sad to hear in such a what is normally a verbose voice.
My organ is much diminished, and I am so sorry.
Speaking of illness, Steve, with your recently acquired knowledge of life on Mars, do you think there will be similar illnesses on Mars?
Well, they cure most things. Nicholas and I, before we began in earnest doing the radio show tonight, we
took on a few drinks, let's be fair.
Fair. And then we talked a little bit about Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, which Nicholas has read Red Mars.
I read Red Mars in a supposed reading group with my father.
And that had all the same complex vibes you would imagine from the phrase reading group with my father. and I meanwhile read Mars with Los Angeles Galaxy, the sci-fi reading group I'm in, but then also read Blue Mars, and then I'm now reading Green Mars and then Blue Mars rather. In the middle of Blue Mars right now, by myself. And I'm so impressed is, I guess, where I'm coming from with that. That's the backstory. So what was your question again? Sorry.
Will we have diseases like the common cold
on Mars? Not at all.
Or strep throat?
Nope. All done. Fixed.
Over.
Done. Yeah.
Well, that's a relief. Will we still have?
Holy shit.
Will we still have difficulties with our fathers? On
yes.
Mars. That's not going anywhere.
Also with your moms. The funny part is do you know the character Hiroko?
I'll be honest, this was like 6 years ago when I made my effort.
Well, Hiroko's children in the subsequent editions of the Mars trilogy have a really weird time dealing with their mom's mythic status.
Jeez.
But anyway, I mean, it's tough. I mean, the funny part, I think, for me also, is that, like, many of my friends have kids now, and it's hard. I'm trying to work my brain around it. Like, it's hard to not think of the children as some sort of weird video game, like a Pokemon or something like that. And at the same time...
Tamagotchi.
At the same time, watching the children view their parents in this mythic way where, like, that interaction is meaningful beyond just being, like, a shitty reading group. You know what I mean? Like, it's like... You could have decided to read a book with any other middle-aged Texan.
Yeah, I'm sure there are other Texans reading the Mars series.
I'm sure there's lots of Texans who like sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
But you did it with your dad because he's your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And watching that, I did it with my dad because he was my dad, interaction with like a two-year-old and like my friend Rick, where we went to the zoo. And
the LA Zoo?
The LA Zoo. And we
Where is
the,
that?
It's near
Griffith,
the old zoo. It's just
Griffith,
in Griffith Park?
Park,
yeah.
Oh, wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's near the Autry.
Also never been there.
Me neither. I've been to the zoo twice. I went to the zoo the first time for a Terry Riley concert.
In the zoo?
Yeah.
What did he do there?
He played piano.
To the animals?
No, in a band shell.
Okay. They have a performance area there.
Yeah, they have a little education center with a band shell in it. And if you went to the concert, you could go around the zoo beforehand. But going around the zoo with a child is so wild. Like, on the one hand, children, like this 2.5-year-old is delighted by thing. Like, has just acquired language. Can okay. just form his first sentences. He is interested in everything evenly.
Huh.
But we think the zoo is because you're interested in animals.
He's interested in, like, the guardrails and stuff?
Yeah, in, okay. like, a fallen leaf.
Okay.
The motion of a dropped ball. Like, he's interested in balls. So he was very interested in, like, tennis balls.
Motion is insane.
So he was, like, interested in playing with a tennis ball. Meanwhile, there was, like, you know, a capuchin monkey freaking out. And that was, like, TV?
Hmm.
You know, that was not the main event. Like, the main event was, like, the ability to, like, hold or think of this ball. And to, like, work on throwing the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, to, like, sort of see the body and the hand interact in the world.
Hmm.
And I don't know. Yeah, it was a really stark illustration of the same sort of father-son relationship where I was like, my friend Rick is like, can I show you the tigers? Because tigers are what? Like, you can't see a tiger.
Ever.
In normal life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see one on the street,
you should run.
You're in trouble.
Yeah,
it's bad for you.
It's not going to go well.
So, you know, he was like, we are in a special situation. I can show you my young son. I can show you a tiger. And son is interested in seeing a tennis ball more than anything. And I think that, like, the reverse of that is your dad being like, this reading group will make sense once you finish the book.
You're like, finish the book, son.
The point is to read this book chapter by chapter together. And like the weird, that interaction is, I think, so clearly seen from the earliest state. Like, there's a point where your dad was like, son, let's go to the airport and watch the planes. And you were like, I'm interested in seeing the cars.
Yeah, or the soccer ball.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah.
This relationship will probably continue. As we enter our 10th year of the Talking Show, I think this relationship is going to enter... You know, when we are doing our 30th year of the Talking Show...
Oh my goodness.
When both Nicholas and I are fathers... Or not, but should such a thing occur, that will definitely have occurred by that point.
Well, at that point, fatherhood will not be the process of fathering a child. It'll be something totally other.
Yeah, it will be like an almond popping out of my forehead and forming into a live human adult.
It may not even be about raising another organism.
It might be about something totally different.
Yeah.
But when we're just going to cover all these bases
mm-hmm.
of how this works, and we've seen it's wow, getting older, something else. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah.
Well.
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 Well. Tonight we have two guests that are deeply sympathetic to the project of the Talking Show, because they speak to each other, they banter once a week, and post these banters online. The subject of their talking is normally the history of garments or the history of fashion. So Steve and I are both very excited to have them. Tonight we have the costume historians, Rebecca Arnold and Beatrice Balin.
Hi, Rebecca. It's Beatrice.
Hi, Beatrice. It's Rebecca. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm okay. And what have you been up to?
Well, what have I been up to? Well, yesterday, I actually caught something on TV. which made me feel very old-fashioned. I think people don't do that anymore.
No, I don't know when I last put my TV on.
I know. And when I had, at one point I wanted to make a cup of tea and I kept thinking, oh, I want to stop this now. And I probably can with the gadget that I have, but I don't know how to do it. So I had to miss a small section.
So you had to watch something in real time.
How in real time. Bizarre. With advertising. I know.
I hate it if I see adverts now. I just think, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Interrupting my viewing. So what did you watch?
Well, I watched, Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
So it was a kind of going back to the future moment.
Yeah, and it's not the first time I watched it. So I don't think I've ever saw it in a cinema. I suspect you haven't either, or have you?
I might have. I think Adrian and I on one of our early dates might have seen it in the cinema. On a not especially, good date.
Because yeah.
I don't think it went down well with either of us particularly.
Yeah, it's not really. I once went on a date to see Apocalypse Now. So that's neither of these are very good date movies, are they? No.
I can't put a gloss on it. They just aren't.
No, but I. It is quite amazing. I think I would quite like to see it in the cinema. Although I've forgotten.
I don't think I remember anything about it.
I'd forgotten how violent it is, and violent and quite a nasty. Violence, I guess, is always nasty, but it's sort of particularly sort of bodily. Quite a lot of sort of knifing going on, which is really nasty, but. I had remembered, the character Sarah Connor. So it's the one with when she's the woman is really almost sort of the main character, and she looks so amazing. And I did remember that, but I not quite like that. So the first time, I think it's the first time you see her. So she's sort of been considered being mentally ill. So she's held in a hospital, and the first time you see her, she's upturned her bed, and she used it to do, what is that called? Not press ups, but when you just hold you hurl yourself up with your arms, or you not hurl.
Oh,
you know
I don't
what I mean?
Know. Dangerous. I think it's called dangerous.
Dangerous. Yeah. So she does that, and for the entire film, I think she's wearing bearing a vest to show off her arms. And I looked, I looked around a bit last night for what other people have said about it, and I found an article, an entire article about her arms in that film. I mean, they are amazing. They are really, really impressive. And apparently she trained 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, which is probably not even that much. I suspect some people like Madonna, they probably train more every day.
But probably it's everybody do. I don't mean everybody does that, but it's before that was really a thing, isn't it?
I guess, yeah, it was in 91 it came out.
Because I think that's before gym. I mean, obviously people did go to the gym, but not in the way they do now.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think. And I think bodies, there wasn't such an expectation of having a gym-honed body.
Mm. And maybe I didn't see it, maybe I didn't read it properly, but I did feel that she really actually did look strong, and even though she was bearing, I can't say it,
the vest.
Most of the time, all the time maybe, she's so far away from Lara Croft, and I did wonder whether Lara Croft was modelled on her in some ways, because she in terms of clothing, it's sort of quite similar, but Lara Croft, it's all very tight, whereas her vests are actually relatively loose. So she doesn't look like a sexual object. She just really genuinely looks like a strong person, which I thought was really interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And while I think it's fine to be a very sexy person, it's good to have options.
Yes.
And yes, I think her vest looks more like a unisex vest than a bulldog clipped at the back to make it as tight as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And she has long hair, so I mean, it's not like they sort of defeminize her in a way. but
Does she wear makeup?
No, not, you know, no lipstick or anything like that. I think she probably does, you know, but obviously, but she it
Yeah,
looks
not.
like, yeah, I think it looks like she doesn't. There are some sort of flashbacks, another thing I can't say, when she's in a sort of waitress, or rather she has this sort of recurrent horrible dream when she sees herself in a sort of pink waitress uniform, and then that she has almost, it looks like permed hair and wears
Wow, that's
makeup.
interesting as well.
Yeah, but not in the main part of the film. And at the end is really, really dramatic, and it's in this factory with molten steel, and this, you know, there are two Terminators, and the not, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is actually really not a nice Terminator in that one. Yeah. Yeah, it's, I know, it's like what is it called? Oxymoron or something.
Yes.
But there is a nasty one who
Okay.
shapeshifts, and he.
That's never good. That's not a good
No,
sign because you don't know
no.
what's going to happen next.
Exactly. And he can turn himself into other people, into men or women, which is, you know, I'm sure there's articles written about that, which is really
Well, if there are
interesting.
ones about her arms, there really should be ones about her
Yeah.
arms.
So but every time he turns into someone else, he becomes molten metal first, and then he adopts this other. Most of the time, he's a cop, which is in itself quite odd, now
Yeah.
that I think of it. But then, yeah, he adopts other people's
But quite fun
looks.
to be metal, molten metal.
Sorry, say again.
It's quite fun to be molten
Yeah,
metal.
I could see that would be quite fun. And every time he gets shot or blasted with something or other terrible things happen, he sort of splits and is silver inside. And
Wow.
then he can self-heal. It that never lasts long. He sort of heals himself really, really quickly. But at the end, there's some sort of very dramatic stuff going on with the molten metal in the factory, etc., etc. I don't want to spoil it for you in case you do.
No, because obviously I will rush to watch it.
Yeah, so in case you do wanna see it. But he also turns into Sarah Connor at the
Really?
end.
Wow.
So that's he can be, yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I've just then I was sort of looking up Sarah the actress, and they're doing another one with her.
Really?
Yeah. So
Okay.
there
Well,
are
let's not go on any dates.
no.
Not take our men folk to see
No,
it.
we could go and watch it.
We could go. We could wear vests and go.
There are pictures of her in a vest, but now she's in her early 60s, and I think that's really interesting because she said, aren't there these sort
Yes.
of weird films? I think, well, they're maybe not weird at all. These films called, I think they're called Expendables or something, and it's Schwarzenegger and Stallone and a
Oh,
few.
I think I've seen posters for them, but I haven't actually seen them.
No, I haven't, but I think it's sort
Where it's
of
older men.
older action heroes, I think.
Oh my goodness.
And they're doing stuff in these films. I'm not quite sure what. And I think she said something about why can't
Well,
women do
I
that
mean
too?
exactly.
Yeah.
Because I mean it's frankly it's a relief that in that film, whatever it's called, that they're actually acknowledging these are older men. And
Yeah.
not just expecting us to pretend they're younger men with
Yeah.
age-appropriate
That's
love
true.
interests.
Yes. Yes,
Well,
that's
I hope
true.
they still have someone who can be molten metal.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder whether it's something else now.
It's probably more high tech now. You don't need to be metal.
Yeah, maybe it's sort of carbon or something.
Oh.
Well, anyway, so that's what I've been up to, really.
That has taken me off guard. That's quite something.
Yeah, I think at the end I will tell you what one thing we should think about. But
Okay.
first I want to know what you've been doing.
Okay, well, I haven't been watching television, but I want to encourage you to just randomly put it on every now and again and let's see what
Yes,
you find.
I will.
But I'm very excited,
Yes.
Beatrice, because Charlie Curran has done this beautiful, beautiful documentary on David Sorrenti, you know, the fashion photographer who died when he was 21. And it's he Charlie sent me a link so that I could see it. Mars is going to be screened for the first time in this country on Wednesday, which is super exciting.
Wow.
And Charlie is going to be there, and there's going to be a Q&A afterwards. It's at the Everyman in King's Cross. And it's just, I really, really loved it because, I mean, we both love our fashion documentaries and we watch lots of them.
Yeah.
But I especially loved this one. I mean, I think David Sorrenti's work has been really underrated, and I think is very, very beautiful. But I love the way this is done. I think you, because like Charlie found out about David Sorrenti actually from Fashion Desire and Anxiety.
Wow. Wow.
Which obviously I loved that, because the idea that people look at my books and then it sparks something is the greatest thing.
Yes.
Ever.
So who is Charlie?
Well, he was at Savannah. He's a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at Savannah College of Art and Design in America. And it's all very serendipitous. It's like my book was just open in the library.
Wow.
And he saw it and then thought, oh my goodness, and then thought, I have to find out more. So he just became really, really fascinated by David Sorrenti and his work. And it's just such a kind of tale of persistence that, you know, Charlie does kind of cinematography, edit, film editing, directing film, and he has just been really tenacious in just wanting to make this film and getting it done. And the Sorrenti family have cooperated with him and kind of let him see David Sorrenti's archives, which had just been closed for 20 years since he died in 97. And it's because Charlie's so genuine in his interest, and I think that really comes in through in the film. And I think that's actually quite a rare thing in a fashion documentary, that it's someone who is just so passionate and interested in this particular aspect of fashion that they feel a need to make a film of it.
And how does that come through, that he saw?
I think from the kind of subtlety of detail and the way the whole look of the film kind of connects with David Sorrenti's work. So I think I really love the way he does context, because I think often, not just in fashion films, but in all kinds of films, context is done in a really clunky way, and you get clips that aren't nicely edited together and that often aren't even of the right period that you're looking
at.
True. But he does these beautiful little clips in between and kind of animated bits, and it's very much, you feel like you're in David Sorrenti's world, and you feel, I think he shows really well how, because the Sorrenti family was in Italy, he was born in Naples, and then they came over to America, and you get this sense of them shifting to New York and what that was like and this kind of adjustment, and then David Sorrenti as a child growing up in New York and being surrounded by like hip-hop culture and really interested in graffiti and music, and you get a good sense of that. And I think that's a really important route into understanding this kind of work, this kind of photography, but also how he was born with a rare form of anemia. So he is having to constantly go to hospital and have treatments, and had this sense of the end, you know, that he was not going to live to be very old.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, I think it could be done in such a crass way, and it absolutely isn't. And I think also because President Clinton picked up on David Sorrenti's death, which, you know, absolutely was tragic, which absolutely should be talked about, but he used it just to say drugs are bad and all of the fashion industry is interested in drugs and that's all it is. And it was a really kind of a sledgehammer way of addressing a significant issue within youth culture, really, at the time, not just fashion. And so I think he gets written off in a sentence, or has been before, as though that's all he represents, and it's obviously not the case. And I think when you look at, I think that the film really enriches the way you understand Sorrenti's photography and the kind of melancholy within his work, and the kind of, like, there's really like a lot of kind of saturated color, but quite dull. Like, even if it's bright color, it's dull, if you see what I mean. It'll be like fuchsia pink, but with a wash over it. And I think that's really beautiful. And I think there's also like a series where you can see he's kind of just letting the models move, And those kind of awkward poses that you've seen a lot in the last like 10-ish years in fashion photography, you can see how that comes out of his work. But with his work, it was kind of, I don't know, almost an expression of the body as fragile and vulnerable. And some of them really look like Francis Bacon photographs, because there are these kind of fields of colour or shades of colour, and then a body that's twisted at the heart of the image. And I think it kind of gives you space. I think the film gives you space to appreciate and understand what fashion photography can do and how reductive it is to say that fashion photography should just be all shiny, happy, bouncy people in, you know, neat clothes. You know, I think that's such a pressure to put on, especially young photographers who are wanting to express what's around them.
Mm.
You know, and clearly wasn't, you know, obviously he comes from this sort of amazing fashion family and was in New York and experiencing all these things, but at the same time, you know, was experiencing really awful things and seeing the rise of like drug, you know, hard drug use in that period.
Yeah.
So I think it's really beautiful.
Mm.
And I really want you to see it because I think you'd love it too.
Yeah, oh, I definitely will. So who does he interview people up as well?
Yes, or? Yes, it's kind of lots and lots of people who knew him. So like his mother, Francesca, who is a fashion photographer, Mario Sorrenti, his brother, Benina Sorrenti. So you get a lot from the family themselves, which is very moving and very beautiful. And then you get models who worked with him, like Jamie King, and you get, you know, like agents and people. So you get a real kind of, and like people he grew up with. So you get a real sort of overview of people who knew him very, very well, both in professional and as friends and as family contexts. So it is like a collage, and I think it does have a really, like, the look of the film is really beautiful, which I think plays into his work, and it doesn't shy away from drug use, it doesn't shy away from that aspect of things, but I think it reinforces what, you know, since I wrote that article on Heron Sheik, which I was writing in 97, I think it really reinforces what I think, that was really about a youth subculture, and it was like a visualization of a subculture which was not the usual way subculture was experienced, because usually it was something on the street and then maybe older people would photograph it. Do you know what I mean? Like more established photographers would photograph it in a kind of ethnographic or more of an ethnographic way. Whereas this was a subculture inhabited by fashion and image people. So it was being created in part through the images.
Mm.
And I think it then got really misunderstood. And also the really important things, like, you know, like there's this really kind of gut-wrenching bit where Jamie King is saying about why was the media coverage like it was at the time, why weren't people thinking, why did a 14-year-old model get exposed to hard drugs by people who were supposed to be looking after and working with her? You know, and I think like Francesca Sorrenti has really lobbied and, you know, tried to try and improve the fashion industry and improve the way it treats people and looks after people, because it is like that thing of children, teenagers being treated like adults and being alone a lot of the time and being put in these sort of circumstances. But yeah, I think you'd really, really love the film. It's so interesting, and as I say, I think Charlie Curran has done an amazing job with it, because it is so evocative of that era, and it's so interesting that, as I say, that it's something that just immediately spoke to him. And I think that is the thing with these photographs, that they weren't, the people who were criticizing them weren't the people they were for, really. And I don't mean that as an excuse, because clearly drug use needs to be addressed in a serious manner, but it was in the way that they needed to address it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Who was he shooting for? Do you know?
He was, I mean, a lot of kind of magazines like Detour and quite a few Japanese magazines. I don't know all of them, but I think he was sort of interesting because he thought of himself more as a reportage photographer, and you can really see how his work links to like Bob Richardson.
Mm.
That he's kind of, there's definitely like artistic work that he's doing that's kind of, it's kind of between documentary, fashion, and art photography.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's also like a point where it's like a transition within fashion photography of the direction it's going to take.
Yeah.
But you can see, you know, the use of the kind of coloured backgrounds, the kind of vulnerable body, things like that, that, you know, he's part of a movement and he's also really important to remember within that genre of photography. So yeah, I thought it was great.
Mm.
And it's brilliant that it's now here. And again, it's just Charlie Curran's just tenacity that he's got this made and that he's, you know, it's doing really well. He's been taking it to various, you know, film festivals and various places. And I hope, you know, I hope everyone goes to see it because I really think it is a beautiful film.
Yeah, it sounds really good. He must be so young.
Well, I know.
Hmm.
I know.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that's what I've been thinking about.
Okay, well, that sounds great, and I'll definitely watch it.
Yes, and now you have to tell me what it is I have to think about.
It now doesn't seem so interesting anymore. You don't need to think about it. I will think about it. I'll think
Could
about.
Could you give me a hint? Yeah. Or are you just going to make me wait a week?
No. It's actually a bit silly, but I thought I'll think about Sarah Connor's best and Bruce Willis best in Die Hard. So
I've never seen the Die Hard film.
Yeah,
so.
I think I've just seen the first one like 5 times by accident, not necessarily by design.
Okay.
It just seems to come on TV a lot when I watch TV. But
okay.
they're both, the vests are in both instances, they are important.
That actually,
so
I want you to think about that. Okay,
I will.
You can tell me about that next week.
Okay. I will do.
Okay.
All right.
Marvelous. All right. Well, I'll see you soon. Then.
Yeah. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
Wow. Well, I knew because of the, you know, there's a. For those of you who haven't been on the show, we have to admit something. The way that Kaechung works, you park in Chinatown, and there's a rather long serpentine walk to the studio. The studio is on the top floor of a building. And so normally, we get quite a bit of time with our guests in advance of the show.
Yeah.
During the walk.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I knew from this walk that
yep.
our guests were sympathizers with the talking show.
Mm.
But little did I know how deeply they understood our project.
Ah.
How they set up a situation where they're there to talk about fashion, but then find themselves pulled in by the tentacles of pop culture to discussing films and TV and whatnot.
Yeah.
That is a decidedly talking show gesture. So tonight, as many of you heard, we heard quite a bit about the clothing in the film Terminator 2. What did you think of the clothes in Terminator 2, Steve?
I mean, from memory, I remember it as a very 90s performance. Like this certain motorcycle boot and leather jacket and a tank top and vest and wraparound shade.
Mm. Sounds to me like you're mostly describing Mr. Schwarzenegger.
But I also feel like Ed Norton wore like what?
Edward Furlong.
Edward Furlong. Oh, God. I'm sorry. I've done this all night. Edward Furlong also wore like a leather jacket, no? And a black t-shirt?
Yeah, it's true. And blue jeans.
Yeah. And
you don't really see kids of that age wearing leather jackets these days.
Leather in general has got a bad smell these days.
Really? I was thinking about getting a leather jacket.
I mean,
I actually have a Terminator 2 leather jacket.
I mean, That's fine. I just feel that, like, I don't see a lot of cool leather now. Like, I don't feel like... Maybe it's because I'm from Canada, and like, in
is
French...
Is it just too cold to wear a leather jacket?
No, or? In French Canada, everyone wears, like, leather everything. Okay. There's, like, this artisanal leather working scene in French Canada, and people wear leather everything.
Hmm.
And, in English Canada, if you see someone wearing a lot of leather, you're like, what are you, French Canadian?
I see.
Just feels like inauthentic unless you are genuinely from, like, Quebec City. Like, huh. If someone's like, oh, yes, I'm from Quebec City, and you're like, oh, okay, well, cool, nice all-leather outfit.
Right. Because I think of the Canadian tuxedo as all denim.
But that's an English Canada tuxedo.
Okay.
That's to say that you're from, like...
Toronto.
Chatham. You're from the suburbs of Toronto. Okay. You're from Peterborough. You could be from a lot of places wearing the Canadian tuxedo. Also, not just the suburbs of Toronto. You could be from Winnipeg. You could be... No one works leather in Winnipeg. One guy, probably. And, like, he gets all the business.
And he's French Canadian.
And he moved there from Quebec City. Yeah, exactly. But, like... Yeah, no, you could live in Winnipeg, you could live in Saskatchewan. In Saskatchewan, if you wear denim on denim on denim, people look at that and say, bitchin'.
Like,
you're cruising down the Ave in Saskatoon, and people say, like, there's a cool-looking dude in Saskatoon.
What's the outfit in the neighborhoods we live in eastern Los Angeles, where people say, bitchin'?
I mean, I think a Canadian tuxedo still gets you a bitchin'. And, you know, especially if you have, like, the hair to go with it.
Yeah. I feel like the leather jacket in these neighborhoods gets you a bitchin', too.
You're like, bitchin'.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Ellen Schaefer. She's got, like, always wears a cool leather jacket. I think bitchin'.
Okay. Okay. I think of Ellen Schaefer's leather jacket as being more, like, elaborate mom style.
Wow.
And transgressive and cool in that respect.
Yeah.
Because she's not a mom.
Has no kids, yeah.
Yeah. But I view it as a specific kind of retro mom.
Okay.
Performance.
That's interesting because she wears a similar leather jacket to the one that Deborah Eisenberg wears, which I knew from my time in Marfa, because she and Wally Shawn used to hang out.
Uh-huh.
And she is rather tall,
mm-hmm.
and very thin,
mm-hmm.
and would wear, like, kind of short skirts and a leather jacket, but she draped the leather jacket in the middle of the summer over her shoulders, and she kind of walked, and she always wore heels.
Yeah.
And she'd walk around town, you know, and the paving there is not even.
No, well, the paving there is not as bad as a European town.
Sure, but it's not a town for high heels.
No, no.
You're not being driven places. You're walking around, you're riding, like, a... kind of beach style bicycle or something that you rented from your hotel.
Although, did you know this? It's actually great to pedal bicycles in heels.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my friend Iris, when we lived in Toronto, and everyone gets around Toronto on bicycles because it's easier than public transit if you live in the central zone. You use the heel as kind of like a way of locking into your pedal.
It's almost like
wearing clips.
Well, Debbie wasn't exploring this aspect of wearing heels.
Right.
She would kind of stork around town. And she looked great. So I think of her when I see Ellen in her jacket.
Fair.
Two very cool ladies.
I can only imagine. I wish I saw more of Ellen Schaefer.
I feel like everyone feels that way.
What an incredible artist in person.
Yeah.
So
what did you think about the whole bit about streaming versus live TV? How Rebecca went downstairs and was captured by the television and a real-time stream of TV with advertisements and everything. Have you been captured recently, Steve?
I feel like I'm so conditioned to be captured by it. Like,
but the opportunity doesn't really present itself these days.
No, that's exactly it. And so as someone, but I think this is the situation is that, like, One is, I was born into a world of broadcast television, and my brain was wired to participate in broadcast television. But then now I live in a world without broadcast television. And so when broadcast television is on, and it's got the ads and everything like that, all the hooks come out and I'm captured.
I see. So like this happened like at like the pharmacy or a doctor's office or the dentist or something?
Or like visiting my parents.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know.
Well, and that's the natural environment in which you were originally captured by.
Where the sociality, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or,
so
or
you're the hooks are fully in.
Or someone else's parents.
That's actually better because it doesn't come with as much baggage.
The baggage isn't there, but the thing with the TV still happens. You're still captured by it. Because I think I was conditioned in childhood in the 80s to understand this way.
I've only watched one thing at the Gold family house.
Your in-laws.
Yeah, unfortunately. And it was that movie, Elle and I were going to Dallas. And we were flying out from LAX early in the morning, and Ella's parents live near LAX, so it made sense to ask if we could sleep over and take a cab. An Uber.
Ein Uber
to the airport, and their parents obliged. And so we stayed there. And it was around Christmas time, and we watched that Patricia Highsmith movie about female homosexuality.
The Price of Salt.
I don't think that was called. Yeah, it was like a almost monosyllabic name.
Oh, it's just a person's name, but it's the same novel.
Yeah.
It's called the novel called The Price of Salt and Carol. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it.
So we watched.
Is that good?
Well, we watched it in our family den, which is very comfortable, but clearly like the audio system is more important given the professions that her parents come from than the TV. So the TV's at kind of an odd angle. Like everyone has to kind of like look to the left to see it no matter where you're sitting.
Wow.
And we watched about half the movie, and you know the erotic charge between the two women in the film is growing and growing and growing. And at some point we were getting rather tired, and Ella's mom said like something like, she just blurted out like, "Just do it already," to the character, and turned it off. She was not having the tension.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know how it ends. But all I know is that
up until
this point, they have not consummated their love.
Yeah. Have you seen or read other Patricia Highsmith things?
So it's interesting that we watched that on the way to Dallas. Because for some reason, growing up, the family film that we always watched during these holiday seasons, my family.
Yeah.
Of all of the films that are like decidedly made for families to connect around the holidays, my family always watched The Talented Mr. Ripley.
That is fucked up.
Totally fucked up. As an adult, I reflect on it thinking like, what were they thinking?
With this charming murderer.
Yeah. Assumes someone else's identity. And kills him. Kills him and then assumes his identity.
Wow. This is your father's family viewing?
Yeah.
All right, so you know what? Tell me if this seems less fucked up to you. What happens in my family is that like I watch The Life of Brian alone.
Okay.
At Christmas time.
Not swimming to Cambodia.
After everyone else has gone to sleep, because they all went to sleep at like 8. And then,
I've never heard of that time.
And then I watch The Life of Brian alone, and then I go to bed. Well, maybe like getting drunk off of like the remnants of a liquor cabinet or something like that. That's what the holidays, that's the movie of the holidays.
Life of Brian.
Well, we turn off the TV. We do the family time. We eat the meal. Everyone goes to bed. I'm an only child. Me and the cat maybe partially watch Life of Brian together, and then I like finish it. They crucify Brian. I'm like, that was a Christmas movie.
Sort of.
And then I go to bed.
Yeah.
Alone.
Well.
Yeah.
I guess growing up in Texas, at least we didn't watch The Passion of Christ every year.
Yeah, like it could have been different. Although, like, do you not feel like it's crazy that, like, evangelical Protestant Christianity has been captured by advanced Catholicism? at this point where, like, everyone's relying on all the deeply Protestant arch Christians in America are relying on Catholics to be their Supreme Court justices. Only because of the issue of abortion, I think. Because it's like, otherwise, they don't trust Catholics. The arch born again Protestant world does not support the papacy. Is not a supporter of European Catholicism. But insofar as they know that those people do not caution abortion, they then feel confident that that is the only person you can, because Protestants can go both ways on abortion, whereas seemingly arch Catholics cannot, and therefore it's only Catholics that can be appointed to the Supreme Court. Like, even when Obama was trying to put that dude on the Supreme Court, what's his fuck?
I don't remember.
The guy that Mitch McConnell blocked until the next election, and then Trump won, and then they put the other fucker on.
I know, it worked out for them, didn't it?
It sure did, but...
There might be another one.
I mean...
I hope she holds out.
Well, I mean, it's her own fucking fault for not retiring under Obama. she knew she was old.
That's a bold statement. You don't
Merrick
know.
Garland. Sorry. So okay. Merrick Garland is also some like Opus Dei Catholic maniac. Like we can't not appoint Catholics to the Supreme Court in America because everyone's terrified of single issue voters. It blows my mind. This system is broken. I as a socialist internationalist, want to abolish the nations. I hope the people in charge of my immigration hearing do not listen to our radio show.
Well, speaking of fashion, like our guest tonight, and of better societies, the talking show has moved on since the cessation of the Game of Thrones.
Oh no, have we?
I have.
You have. Okay.
I was pretty disappointed in the end, so I'm done. You know, cut the umbilical cord. And we've moved on to deep discussions of the politics of Deep Space Nine. I'm curious what you think, Steve, of the outfits in Deep Space Nine.
Love them.
In particular, I'm in a rather horrid moment of the series where they're exploring, what are those cops, the Federation cops who... their beat is to cover... jumping back in time, time space delinquency or something like that.
Yeah, well, there's also Division 37 or whatever.
It's something that has to do with like when you accidentally jump back in time, which I guess happens when you're like fucking with wormholes.
Yeah,
these guys come and interview you to make sure like you didn't like you know turn the world into donuts or something. But they go back to like the Captain Kirk era. In this episode.
Oh, that episode is so good.
Yeah.
Where the Klingons are different and Worf is like...
We don't talk about that. Exactly. That's amazing. But anyhow, I was fascinated by... well, there's this scene where they're getting dressed. They're getting dressed to go back and it's like... You know, like they're really perplexed because each of them are wearing different colors. It's like, wait, you're a medical officer. Why are you wearing blue? Oh, well, in the 23rd century, the medical officers wore blue and the commanding officers wore yellow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's bizarre. And then like off camera, Dax says, and the women wore nothing. And they cut to her and she's wearing a skimpy skirt.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But anyhow, and then they cut to Odo and Worf who are dressed like sheep herders.
Yeah.
Like the others of the Federation in the 60s were just dressed like, you know, like they lived in the Ukraine or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That was bizarre.
But
they had great pockets. Like, their outfits had incredible pocket systems for, like, storing all sorts of stuff in an age where, like, everything fits into a tricorder.
Have you seen that episode of The Next Generation where Worf goes, it's a holodeck episode where they are doing Robin Hood? And Worf says,
"That's a classic. We should
reenact. I am not a merry man." He's got great pockets in that outfit too.
Yeah.
No, you know who have there's this like sort of like godlike, almost Q-style game player entity who exists in like maybe season 3 of Deep Space Nine is wearing this layered robe garment, similar to what's his name, the guy who was the president of Afghanistan after the war.
Angela Merkel.
No. God, he was such so good at style. he was bad at being the president of Afghanistan.
That's a tough job, let's be fair.
Very tough job.
In terms of presidential jobs, like that's up there.
Not Ashraf Ghani. Hamid Karzai.
Karzai?
Hamid Karzai. Hamid Karzai was a very stylish man. And there was this Deep Space Nine man who had like a similar multi-layered robe garment set up to Hamid Karzai that I thought was one of the best outfits I've ever seen in Star Trek.
He does have great outfits.
You just Googled Hamid Karzai.
Yeah.
Wait,
he's also a beautiful man. Look at that.
He's got great bone structure. He's a good-looking dude.
And like, it's hard to pull off the floppy ears like that. And he really rocks it.
Look for like a full body Karzai where he's wearing the full cape and you can see like the total outfit.
It's incredible. That's not an easy Google. Ooh, he's got a darkened finger there.
He voted. Yeah, go back.
He just looks like he's graduated, got a PhD.
He wears these amazing capes. They're so good. In this multi-layered banded collar.
Look at him with Obama.
With a jacket and then a cape over top. It's so good. This is the way to look. I have thought of like sort of Rei Kawabuko times Hamid Karzai.
Yeah.
Is like the way that I imagine I should dress.
You got pretty close to your wedding.
Ukrainian shirt and just regular jacket.
Than you are today.
Fair. Folks, we've really cooked this episode all the way down to its component parts. Let's just upload this thing to the internet.
Okay. Good morning, Chinatown.
Thank you.